We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by Karine Hajjar. She's an incoming RAGO fellow for the Fund for American Studies, where she'll be with the Wall Street Journal. She's been traveling Europe recently as part of a fellowship with Harvard. She's writing at karine.substack.com. Karine, thanks so much for joining Federalist Radio Hour.
Thanks for having me on, Emily.
Now, a lot of the credentials I just listed off, I'm sure, came amid your bravery at Harvard. You're a 2021 graduate of Harvard, where you started writing a column for The Crimson that was fairly conservative, actually, and got some attention for that. And you're an excellent writer. So it makes sense that all of the success that's come your way certainly makes sense. I wanted to start just by asking you, have you always been a conservative? Did Harvard make you into a conservative? What's your background look like just in terms of your politics?
Sure. And thanks for the kind words. I think that Harvard definitely forced me to more clearly articulate my views and to define them more clearly. So in one of my last pieces for my column, I say that if you're not progressive and at Harvard, it's going to force you to have the best education of your life, because you really are forced to say exactly what you believe and to defend it rigorously. But I had grown up in a conservative family. I actually do think my views differ a lot from theirs. There are a lot of strains of thought that fall under the conservative umbrella. But I think my time at Harvard really, I'm very grateful for it, because it helped me to really articulate what I believed. And you kind of find those mentors that are like-minded and help you out through that process and through kind of the ideological battles that you face.
Yeah, so you would have started at Harvard in 2017, is that right?
That's right, yes.
So right in the Trump administration, like Trump takes office, a few months later, you're in Cambridge. What was the atmosphere like on campus in 2017?
Well, as much as, well, it's probably exactly what you would expect. It was a lot of complaining, aversion to anything to do with Trump. And as a conservative student, you are often lumped in under the Trump administration. So any conservative was Trump. You were complicit. You were upholding all of the worst aspects of that administration. There was no credit given to the good aspects of the administration. So it was definitely a tough time to not be progressive.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk to you particularly because, at least on this program, we dedicate a lot of time to covering this pipeline from academia, especially elite academia, but certainly state schools as well, into the working world and the way that's really shaped and influenced our culture and changed the way our the arbiters, the gatekeepers of our culture make their decisions and the incentive structure and all of that good stuff. Your first column for The Crimson, if I'm not mistaken, I think I have it right here, was called "I'm Scared to Write This Column." Is that right? That's the first one
that
came out as a conservative. Tell us about that. Tell us about your experience writing that, why you decided to do it, and what the reaction was like.
Well, it had been, I was definitely one of those conservative girls at Harvard. Like, people knew that I definitely wasn't progressive, but I kept it pretty quiet, and I was involved with a lot of political organizations on campus, enjoyed my time, but kind of kept my head down a lot of that time. And in my, I majored in government, so I also kind of kept my head down, or at least self-selected for classes where I'd be able to speak more freely. But I wrote that one in particular because I finally got to the point where I wanted to say very clearly that I think that there is a problem. And saying that you think that there's a problem with free speech on campus amounts to saying you disagree with woke culture on campus. And that is seen as an attack on not just like academic norms at Harvard, but also social norms. So as a not just as a student, but as a friend, as somebody who interacts in clubs, interacts with different friend groups, it can be very alienating to label yourself as thinking that, hey, I'm not actually this woke, or I'm not this progressive, and I actually think it's creating a problem on campus. And I think that just shows that a lot of elite universities right now are allowing very progressive students to take the reins on campus discourse, whether it's academic or even just extracurricular and social, and sending the message that it's okay for not only for you to disagree with any opinion that's not your own, but also to alienate it and to create a world and, or at least like a college ecosystem where you can alienate those people socially, academically, and then going on professionally as well. So I thought that was pretty scary, and it for a long time scared me into not speaking, but also scared me into speaking in the end because it's just wrong.
So what's fascinating about what you just said is that perhaps as you know, you have this collection of highly intelligent and accomplished people gathered at a school like Harvard, and you have a sort of increasingly facile and staid ideology that is dominant. Intelligent people are increasingly, it sounds like, going to be a little bit curious and perhaps a little bit skeptical of the dogma. And maybe I'm overstating it, but did you see that happening during your time at Harvard, and maybe even now, just as a young person? Are people starting to question this?
I totally think they are. I had a lot of friends who were, I think that there's a silent majority where people think, you know, this is ridiculous, but there's one camp where you're a math major, so you're not really involved in those conversations, or, you know, you take your liberal arts requirement, you kind of gloss through it, and that's fine. You don't have to think about it. But there's another camp where people are generally annoyed, but they don't want to incur the social costs and even sometimes the professional costs of saying, hey, I don't agree with this excessive wokeness, and I'm not ultra progressive, but it's just not worth my time and social capital to speak out about this.
Well, that was, yeah, I read an interview you did, I think, with a College Fix. And one of the things you mentioned when they were kind of asking you about your experience coming out as a conservative at Harvard is you mentioned that actually students on the left thanked you for what you did. And I wanted to ask more about that, because it's not surprising to me. It might be surprising to some, but I also think that it speaks to that dynamic we were just talking about. Like, people realize there are much more interesting conversations to be had than what you sort of allowed within the parameters at Harvard to have. So when people were reacting and you got actually some gratitude from people on the left, what was that like? Why did you get the sense that they were grateful?
Well, first of all, it was surprising because people really do stay tight-lipped on campus if they have any dissenting views. But after the shock wore off a little, it was also validating that this is an issue. And in a way, it made me optimistic because it showed me that, like, even some very, very progressive peers are sick of this type of orthodoxy and they want to learn different views, different ideologies. And it's funny because I took a conservative philosophy class my last semester of senior year, and it was chock full of like ultra progressives in the government department. So, you know, and I think it was like mind blowing for a lot of people because you actually never learn about different facets of conservative ideology. But getting those little notes of gratitude, you know, shows that there definitely is a problem, but that it also gave me a little hope too. Like, people are getting sick of it. And it's funny because I saw a peer or a former peer of mine from Harvard a couple months ago, and he was kind of my progressive counterpart at the Crimson. And he had changed his tune on a lot of topics about free speech and just generally was sick of not being able to ask dissenting questions. So I think people are just getting sick of it.
Huh. Well, yeah, that's interesting, because another thing I wanted to ask you about was 2020. What it was like to be, first of all, you're hardly alone in having experienced the lockdowns as a college student, but I imagine that had an effect on the politics of campus. I'm sure it had effect on the sort of social life and the mental health of you and your peers. But the political dynamics on campus, I also imagine, were affected by that. And 2020 is where it seemed like everything that was building up during 2017, I mean, 2017 is a year that Berkeley was burning, literally, like on fire over a Miley Yiannopoulos speech. It seemed like from 2017 to 2020, things just absolutely exploded. How pivotal was that year, in your opinion, in sort of the political dynamics on campus?
Well, I think for one thing, I absolutely agree that it exploded. And I think people being behind their screens emboldened more conformity, and people who were always they were the spokespeople for like a woke order on college campuses just had even more power. And then people who disagreed were even more silenced. So being behind the screen and not being on campus, that was a big issue, but also just fear of, you're on Zoom. And sometimes I would be afraid if I'm in class or in that conservative class I mentioned, who's to stop one of my peers from filming me? And there were rules against, there are always like guidelines against that, but you had the Crimson come out against, there was like a free speech policy at Harvard Law that said that you can't record or hold your peers accountable for questions or things they say during their law school classes. And the Crimson came out against that. There's this current here where it's kind of like a gotcha culture, and people are always afraid of being canceled. And then you also have progressive peers saying cancel culture doesn't exist at the same time. So it's just this environment of paranoia. And ultimately I got so sick of it, and that's what led to the column. But I think a lot of people felt the opposite way, that they were so paranoid that there's no point in arguing anymore.
Right. Because the reward is, it doesn't outweigh the risk of being called, a white supremacist bigot. Like the risk there is so high that the reward seems in so many people's mind to be outweighed by the fact that you're going to be equated with David Duke, like literally, right, in so many different ways. But another thing that stood out to me about your story, as you just mentioned, is that the Crimson gave you the space to make these arguments. You just completed a fellowship with Harvard. You apparently were given some, space by the school. You weren't kicked out of school. I'm sure I don't want to minimize at all the backlash that you face and bravely endured, because that's a lot. But you still, it's conceivable to me that your fellowship would have been taken away or never would have happened in the first place at different schools and different times. I'm even a little surprised that they held on after, you wrote these columns, which were super brave. So it seems like Harvard actually gave you some opportunities to make these arguments, hard as it must have been.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, honestly, I was just pointing out the obvious, and that was it. and I'm really good. I mean, the first thing people ask me about my time at Harvard when they're talking about the free speech issues and everything is that I'm extremely grateful for it. For one, I really enjoyed the education. And like I said earlier, it forced me to really hone my views. But two, it's not that the administration doesn't welcome different ideas, dissent. There is a free speech policy. I think professors miss having fiery debates in class. I took a course with Jill Abramson, who's from the New York Times, and she said when I was at Harvard, she was a undergrad, we used to have these massive debates in class. I don't understand why that's not happening anymore.
Jill, yeah. Come on. Yeah, maybe it had something to do with what you're publishing at the Times.
Yeah, but so to hear that from Jill Abramson and you wonder, like, what the heck happened? And that really led me to the conclusion that this is a student issue. This is really, the administration doesn't want protest on protest on protest. And so they're allowing this norm to happen. But really, the students are the ones driving, like, the social cost of speaking out against progressive norms. It would be very unsurprising to me if you didn't get into a social organization, an extracurricular organization, if you were, as you said earlier, labeled a racist, which is just like the end of your college social life. If you are labeled a racist for whatever reason, it's just the end. So I think it's a student-led phenomenon, and the university just allows it to kind of happen.
So many Americans are looking for alternatives to the stock market and are looking to diversify their 401ks into more stable assets. It is considered prudent to place a portion of your retirement income into a precious metals IRA or to invest directly in gold or silver. There are many tax benefits associated with such an investment. Savvy investors know that gold has historically outperformed the stock market and helped the wealthy protect their assets through rough financial storms. Goldman Sachs analysts expect gold to rise to $2,500 by the end of 2022. Now is the time to protect your IRA with precious metals. Call the experts at Allegiance Gold, 844-790-9191. Allegiance Gold has been helping Americans protect their retirement and legacy for years. And when you call today, you'll get a bonus $500 in silver free for all qualifying accounts. Just mention this ad. Call 844-790-9191 today. That's Allegiance Gold, 844-790-9191, and get your $500 in silver today. Yeah, I didn't mean to put you on the spot by criticizing your professor. I've just very much enjoyed Jill Abramson's frustrations with the media these days, because I think some of it, you know, happened. She's one of those people who's like, this was sort of happening under their watch and nobody expected it to sort of metastasize into what it did. It's like, oh, we didn't see it coming. But how much actually the professor part of that is also really interesting, because a lot of this, it seems to me, and I've worked on these issues for Young America's Foundation, and obviously was a college student myself, administrators play a huge role in sort of fueling some of this discontent on campus, or the discord, I should say, on campus. Was that your experience at Harvard, that there were administrative programs or administrative language, ideas, policies that were pushed in a way that was divisive or increased that sense of paranoia that you mentioned?
I think the biggest factor is a passive administration with a lot of these issues. They just kind of allow like excessive protests to happen. I think that's the biggest issue, but you do see like there's massive bureaucratic bloat at universities, and you have all of these different departments for anything you could imagine. And a lot of them create the sort of idea that free speech among students is dangerous. So you had, I think it was at Colorado State University last year, had a sign up for a department that would assist their students if they've been, quote, affected by free speech or mm-hmm. something like that. essentially, like, there are departments being built to help students who feel offended by free speech. So I think that the first step was the administration was kind of passive and didn't want to deal with protests on their doorstep every day. And so they kind of let progressive students run with it. And the second step has been accommodating that with all of the departments that you see at universities. And people forget too that, I mean, if we look at the university as an industry in the US,
yes,
it's one of the biggest industries. I think it's between, there's more money in universities than electric in the US. So it's massive. And you want to, quote, protect your market share. So if you have a lot of angry woke alumni, a lot of angry students who aren't going to want to pay their tuitions, aren't going to want to come to your university if it isn't progressive enough, then you have a problem on your hands. So those kind of market shares are on the minds of administrators.
Something that gives me the most, let's say, like, ambient anxiety about our politics, it seems to have been exposed in the reaction to a column you wrote about patriotism. And I have a quote from that column here. It was called, "Patriotism is complicated, more so at Harvard." Your first sentence was, "It's hard to be patriotic at Harvard. Socially, it's the kind of pressure that would make you shy away from throwing a USA-themed party or posting a purely celebratory post on the 4th of July or Memorial Day. It's the fear that there would be backlash, the fear of being asked, how could you celebrate such a flawed country?" Granted, this is coming from students at Harvard, who, at least in the scope of human history, in the scope of the entire world right now, are some of the most privileged, blessed people in the world. Whatever background they came from, they are at Harvard. They have been given an incredible opportunity, and they're experiencing a high standard of living. So to not be able to celebrate America, which created that opportunity for all of those students at Harvard. Again, this is the anti-Americanism, the sort of inability for people to buy into the country and the fundamental goodness, not fundamental in the fundamental irredeemability of the country, I think is something that a lot of people, younger people, definitely feel. That's really scary. Can you talk more about why just a pro-American perspective at Harvard? It's Howard Zinn's. It's his 100th birthday, by the way, while we're talking about it. As everyone's heading back to campus, it's Howard Zinn's 100th birthday. But that anti-Americanism, what character is that? Like, does that take in your experience, what was that like at Harvard?
Well, to put it simply, if you were patriotic, you were racist. Or... Jeez. I mean, it's just, and that's among, of course, like the very, very progressive students there. Like I said, there is a silent majority that does not think this way, but among a very vocal minority, patriotism accommodates feelings of racism because of our country's legacy of slavery in the past. So that was one of the issues. Also, I mean, and then you start bringing it down. Any legacy of homophobia, any legacy of xenophobia, all of these things. Essentially, patriotism is a catch-all for all of the negative parts of our American history. And, you know, I made it clear in that column that it's not that this country is perfect or has been perfect. There have been plenty of flaws, but like you said, if you're a student at Harvard, you're extremely privileged. You're going to go on to have presumably a lot of power or influence. And it's a shame to think that some of my peers are going to go into the workforce, be public servants, do whatever they're going to do with such a negative idea of their country. I'd rather go in with a realistic view of the flaws, but a general sense of celebration and gratitude so that I can work to make it better. So I was just sort of alarmed that there was that students were that jaded, and that was not to dismiss the issues that this country has. It was to even to elevate them, to say, hey, like, let's not make the same mistake, but you have to love your country to even have the zeal or the, you know, the intention to not repeat those mistakes and to go and work to make it better. If you don't like something, you're not going to work to make it better.
Right. Yeah. And that's exactly exactly my looming sense of dread about this anti-Americanism is exactly that. If you don't buy into it, you have no reason to be improving your immediate community, to be voting, to be educating yourself on how to vote. And I guess I'm curious about that gray. So for the silent majority, I'm curious about even that idea of there being a gray area about whether America is redeemable or utterly irredeemable from, you know, the first stroke of the pen of the founding. I worry that the sort of extreme silent minority on campuses like Harvard and in our popular culture in general is dragging the silent majority into a gray area when it comes to the goodness of the United States. And maybe I'm being overly concerned about something that you didn't see or you didn't experience, but it seems to me that creating any sense of doubt about the country and the country's goodness is, you know, that's not to say we should all be learning propaganda, but I think it's fairly obvious I think the goodness of America is fairly obvious despite all of our flaws. So that gray area seems to be a very dangerous one.
No, absolutely. And I don't know, I can't speak for the gray area exactly how they feel, but I can say that at least like this very vocal minority is creating a structure where it is hard to work towards making the country better or to say that it is better. And that's the danger. Like, we're creating an institution, at least like when you're looking at academia, you're creating an environment where celebrating American values, celebrating the founding values is frowned upon. And then a lot of these people go on into powerful jobs, powerful professions, and they're bringing that with them. So that's pretty alarming. Like, even if you feel the way that you and I feel, you're kind of in an environment where you can't express it or act on it.
Right. And I'm not trying to make you like the spokesperson for your generation, but I am going to keep, we're actually not that different in age. I graduated college in 2015. So right in the sort of heat of the Title IX battles and everyone was talking about rape culture and the trans stuff was really starting to heat up. So it was also a very unpleasant time to be a conservative on a college campus. But I wonder, there have been a lot of changes in social media, actually, even since I graduated from college, and especially thinking about 2020 when everything sort of went over Zoom and Zoom became a norm. It became a normal way to do various activities on campus. I'm sure it replaced some sort of aspects of civil society on campus, even just incrementally. Even if there are things that used to be in person that are now on Zoom, but even if those things are sort of minimal, that has an effect, I imagine, on camaraderie, on fellowship, on one another and just the way people treat each other. And social media is sort of, you add that to this conversation where people are increasingly interacting with avatars instead of face to face, that has to be fueling some of the discord on campus. Can you talk about what that was like?
Oh, absolutely. I think the first thing that comes to mind is a lot of like COVID related shaming. When students were mostly off campus or when it was like kind of a hybrid model, you had other students on social media calling them out. Are you wearing a mask? Are you socializing with friends? Are you in groups of X amount of people? And I think that was really hard. I'd kind of graduated before that really blew up. But certainly I felt some of that. And again, like a gotcha type of culture where you feel like you're always being watched and somebody's trying to get you in trouble. So social media just creates more vigilance. And when everyone's on their computers all the time, it's really easy to know what people are up to and to call them out on everything. So, but I think that was the case for the entire country too. Just emboldens people, fans the flames.
Right. Now, you've spent about the last year as part of your fellowship traveling, mostly Europe, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
All right. Tell us about that. That has to have been, I mean, it's sort of, I took a look at your Substack and I saw in your intro to your Substack, you kind of winking and nodding at the idea that this is a cliche after you graduate college, you sort of take on the world with a backpack and travel. But what has that been like? And, you know, are there any big lessons? That's probably a big question since it's been a year, but are there any big lessons that stand out to you?
Well, I guess this falls under the umbrella of me being very grateful to Harvard. And there are spaces within academia that kind of fund really interesting and eye-opening experiences. And basically I proposed to Harvard, I wanted to go backpack Europe and stay at Catholic monasteries and spend a year thinking about my faith. And this was all a part of a personal growth fellowship that I was offered. And so I'm very grateful to them for that. And that's exactly what I did. I went off with just my backpack and I traveled, I think the end tally was 14 countries. I ended up staying at seven different Catholic monasteries across those 14 countries and just experiencing life and with different Catholic religious orders. So I was, the most recent one was a Benedictine order in Salzburg. Actually, it was the monastery in the Sound of Music. So you just get these really interesting opportunities to think about life outside of academia, have this time to meditate. For me, it was a very spiritual experience, but also just a chance to see the world and to meet people, whether it be in the monasteries, but also in the hostels. And I met people from all over the world, different countries, old, young, and it reminded me that there are different outlooks to life. Not everyone is ultra progressive. You don't have to hold your tongue all the time. But there are just so many ways to approach politics, religion, life. So it was really eye-opening and refreshing after feeling very constricted for a few years.
Right. You can sort of escape the American left-right paradigm. You strike me as somebody who's read The Benedict Option by Rod Dreher.
I haven't, no, but so many people have told me, why haven't you read this yet?
Okay, I was going to ask you about the Benedict option, but yeah, you should absolutely, instead I will recommend it to you.
Okay, sounds good.
No, you'll probably like it a lot. One thing I think about a lot was this Washington Post survey. I want to say it was like 2016, and they were asking, I'm paraphrasing it, millennials at the time, what sort of worship experience they would be most interested in. And it was kind of surprising to the people who took the poll, but it was like a rebuke of the idea that people want to go to the sort of jean-clad youth pastor with a Britney Spears microphone type environment. And at the time, I don't think that was had quite manifest in popular culture. But now there's clearly something going on with young people and Catholicism in particular, especially Orthodox Catholicism. The Latin Mass is resurgent. By a lot of reports, and especially with young people, by a lot of reports. The New York Times has even reported on the sort of Catholic hipster youth, like the surge of Catholic hipster youth in Manhattan. Why do you think that there's growth in that space right now? Is it connected to, here's a leading question, the sort of high-tech dystopia that is making life for young people, you know, inundating people with pornography, inundating them with hate on social media, inundating them with materialism, that an escape is kind of Orthodox Catholicism? What's going on?
Well, I think that's certainly true. And I think it's just like the general, this general current in postmodernist thought where like your subjective truth is truth. I don't think that's cutting it for enough young people. I think it's creating a lot of insecurity and confusion. There is truth. There is right and wrong. And I think we can all sense that. But you're constantly being told, especially like in youth culture, that your truth is your truth all the time, and that you can determine what's right and wrong for you. And it kind of goes a step further to where that's right and wrong for everyone else. So for me, I think that there is kind of a return to faith. And it's interesting because I met a ton of converts at Harvard who during their time at school converted to Catholicism, or different, also a few Protestants that had converted, that were just really looking for tradition and something that was bigger than just themselves. I think that
something that's enduring,
enduring, right? Something that's tried and true. You know, your Instagram feed is powered by an algorithm that changes with every click of something. And it seems that life is just fueled by your different whims, different desires when it comes to the technology that you're talking about. But I think that, you know, my generation can sense that there is something deeper, and they're looking for that. And for me, that is absolutely in the church.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a Lutheran mega church goer, so I don't really have a lot of ground to stand on here. But I wonder if that gives you hope. If that's something that, I guess it's been really strange to kind of watch in the decades since I left campus, things get worse and then almost get worse to the point where it's like, to solve the problem, we had to go through it. We had to, you know, get to the other side. And I'm still not optimistic that's what's happening, but it seems to be a possibility. And what gives me way more hope is not merely that the Crimson gave you a column, but that on a non-political level, on a cultural level, people are turning even away from politics and turning to spirituality. I'm kind of terrified by the trends of astrology and Wicca and paganism, like just completely surging right now commercially. And, you know, my colleague John Daniel Davidson is covering that right now at length, and it's definitely something worth thinking about. But are you optimistic, having sort of gone through this and actually leaving Harvard and having warm feelings about their support for you and seeing the world, are you feeling hopeful when you look to the future?
I do. I do feel optimistic. Some people call me a hopeless optimistic, but but I do feel very hopeful. And I think, you know, at a lot of these monasteries I stayed at, people are surprised, but you have non-religious people coming to stay almost like just for like a peaceful retreat, a meditative retreat. And I met a lot of young people who I would get to talking to me and asking me about religion and asking like really interesting questions and really interested questions. And you know, you have to conclude that they were brought here for a reason, and they're really wondering, they're really looking for answers. And I saw that a lot with my peers too. People are genuinely interested. And at first I was worried to talk about my experience, to write about it publicly on Substack and to do that. But I've had so much positive feedback, so many of my peers from Harvard and just other readers asking more questions and interested about investing time into personal growth and into really understanding what you believe and how that applies to the rest of your life. I think, you know, a lot, I like have a lot of respect for my friends who graduated, went straight to work. That was certainly my plan until I got the fellowship, but I'm so grateful now that I had time to sit and think about what I really wanted to do and how I really wanted to impact the world and what those views that I was going to share were going to be. And I'm so grateful to the Fund for American Studies and the journal for giving me that answer as to what am I going to do and how am I going to share those views. So everyone's just looking for something tried and true and something bigger than themselves. And it's just a question of if you have the time or will to find it.
Well, a glimmer of optimism for any students or heading back to these Howard Zinn 1619 infested campuses and parents sending their kids back to those campuses. Karine Hajjar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Karine is an incoming RAGO fellow for the Fund for American Studies, where she will be at the Wall Street Journal. Make sure to look out for her there. You can find her writing at karine.substack.com. I'm Emily Jashensky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I heard the faint voice of reason. It faded away.